Welcome to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z, covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. It is Wednesday, August 8th, and we are barely getting through this week. I know if you're paying attention to the news, there is a lot that's going on. Just a few things that I can tell you that's on top of my mind. Many thoughts, many prayers, many sad emotions about the Northern California fires. All three of those fires have been combined, and so it's now being referred to as the Mendocino Complex Fire. So if you think about how big of a fire this is, I think it's a fire the size of Los Angeles is what they're saying. And so lots and lots of homes, thousands, have been destroyed. Many families have been displaced and lives have been lost. So really sad feelings and thoughts. Laos continues to be on my mind, and that is the country of Laos and the area called Atapu, in which there was a $1.2 billion dam project. The entire dam is set to cost around that much, and this was a part of it that had it broke. And so there was flooding, over 6,000 families displaced, I think, up to about 100 folks severely injured or have passed away. And so there have been some relief efforts there. So sadness in just kind of thinking about the fact that our environment continues to evolve. And I know that, you know, for those of you who are denying climate change, I feel sad for you. I really do. And I hope that you will do some reading, because it's obvious that our world is getting hotter, and it's obvious that these man-made decisions that we make that impacts people, it kills people. We kill people. Today's show is a great show. We have an interview with activist Mark S. King, who is a blogger and author. He started his blog and started doing writing covering HIV topics back in 1985 when he was diagnosed with HIV. A lot has happened, and he's covered the World AIDS Conference that happened in Amsterdam this year. And so we'll talk to him and get his thoughts about, you know, the evolving or the evolution of HIV issues, where we're at with stigma, shame, and fear, and the kind of work that we still have left to do. And also, you know, just interesting perspective that even HIV issues are intersectional. It's intersectional in that it also can cover topics and issues of racism and certain structures and systems that prevent resources or access to resources and how that kills people. I also do a little bit of talking at the very end in talking about the public charge changes that might come. And some of you might have heard of this, but there have been some drafts that have been leaked out there in which the Trump administration is trying to expand on the public charge policy when it comes to applying for a green card. Basically, anybody who is benefiting or receiving government aid could be considered a public charge, therefore denied status in this country. So we'll talk a little bit about that. I hope you enjoy the program. Today's program is brought to you by Pacific Fertility Center. When life needs a little encouragement, Pacific Fertility Center will be right by your side. Visit pacificfertilitycenter.com. Welcome to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z, covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. Our next guest is joining us by phone, and he is an award-winning writer and blogger who has been advocating on behalf of those living with HIV since testing HIV positive in 1985, and I'm very, very excited to have him here on the program, Mark S. King. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for the invite, Michelle.
Yeah, so I actually have been a fan of your blog for a while now, since at least, you know, starting my career over 10 years ago, My Fabulous Disease, and it's a three-time GLAAD Award award nominee in terms of you and you starting this. So, but a lot has changed, and obviously we can agree with that as members of the LGBTQ community, but in covering HIV issues and I, you know, I sometimes I like to take a look back before we start talking about the now. And I guess I'd like to start with just kind of your thoughts. You've been covering this for so long. How have things have changed? I mean, how have they changed for you as someone covering this topic?
Well, gosh, I mean, it's the difference between night and day, or the blackest midnight versus, you know, morning has broken. Just in terms of, obviously, the mortality rates that we're seeing in the United States, and just the level. I mean, I come from a time, you know, I tested positive about 2 weeks after the test was invented to find HIV in your body in 1985. And certainly the environment I lived in then, which was absolutely no drugs, no sense of how to treat this disease or what we were going to do about it, and an atmosphere of constant mortality and death and dying, it really was, you know, a nightmarish time. And I believe that that history of ours, because we as an LGBTQ community rose up together and mounted a response, a community response. Certainly there was lots going on in medicine and research to do it, but without that, we as a community stood up and said, we're going to fight against the discrimination and the stigma and the hatred and the fear of people living with HIV and dying of AIDS, and we're going to care for them. That may be the proudest moment we as a community may have, I believe, seen in our lifetime, certainly. And that is our caring for the sick and the dying, and our standing with them, alongside them. And I counted myself as one of those. I certainly thought that I was a goner within a couple of years. And I lived that way, kind of in two-year increments, for a number of years, 20 years, before effective medications came along in the late 90s that turned everything around. So, yeah, there's an enormous difference and a lot to be grateful for, and yet we still need to keep our eye on the ball. We still need to be vigilant, and we still have to fight social stigma against people with HIV, which I believe is probably as bad as it's ever been, despite our medical breakthroughs.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Thank you so much for beautifully saying that, because I know that that was a big question. I mean, how do you answer that with decades worth of work evolving to what it is today? Today, you know, you had just covered the World AIDS Conference, or AIDS 2018, in Amsterdam, and just hearing you talk about where we were, and feeling isolated or not feeling like we had the support, to creating the support for ourselves. I mean, what's the community of support like now? It's a worldly effort. It's a global effort.
It is a global effort, and certainly the AIDS crisis continues to be a crisis, depending on where you live. Depending, you know, HIV and the crisis is always dependent on stature, privilege, money, resources, all of those things. And so we as a developed nation have always had advantages that other people haven't. Then again, within our within our country, you look at where the, you know, HIV always follows the path of least resistance. It seeks out those communities which are most vulnerable because they lack education or resources or access to health care. So, of course, now you see new infections and deaths among gay black men in the southern United States that are as bad and in some cases worse than sub-Saharan Africa. That's how bad we, and that is a disgrace that we as a nation have allowed, of course, health care, access to information about safer sex education, all of those things, that all of those things intersect in the South. And that's why you're seeing such terrible infection rates and mortality among gay black men. So you look at the world as a whole, and what you're going to find is in those nations that have progressive ideas, progressive values about health care, about what it means to be LGBT or a sex worker or a transgender person, all of those things, when they line up correctly, you're going to see low rates of HIV. When they don't, you won't. Yes, it's a global response. Amsterdam was amazing. The Dutch are welcoming people, and certainly gay men in the Netherlands are extremely sex positive and well-informed, and as a result, you're seeing lower infection rates, much higher level of education.
I want to talk about, you know, other countries a little bit later, but for right now, I want to focus on the United States and something that you had said in terms of, you know, how bad it is for certain segments of our community, which it's somewhat shocking. I mean, when you've got cities like San Francisco, big major urban cities, home to a good, you know, definitely heavily populated, but has existing neighborhoods for LGBTQ people and resources who have campaigns, who have efforts to get to zero. And, you know, what does that mean? Getting to zero is, zero new infections. When you've got campaigns like that and then compare it to what you were just talking about, those impacted, for example, you know, black gay men in the South, I mean...
Right.
What can be done? I mean, are we learning what those solutions are? And you talked about some of the things that need to align, but is it a question of racist systems that, you know, don't deliver the resources that we need? Is it a question of being impacted by a geography? Like, I guess what I'm trying to get at is the root problem, even in our own home.
Well, and those root problems are the same problems that plague us as a nation in general, the kind of values that you and I most likely share in terms of equality, gender equality, the equality of LGBTQ people, the equality and the lifting up of people who are marginalized, whether it's socially or economically. Those are factors that affect people's health, period, across the board, and certainly when it comes to HIV. So you know it should be no surprise. It's just a tragedy that a gay black man living in Mississippi right now has a 50% chance of contracting HIV in his lifetime. 50%, 1 in 2, he will become HIV positive. And if and when he does, his chances of going on to develop AIDS, not getting treatment that he deserves, much less the education to have prevented his infection in the first place, not to get the treatment he deserves, and the likelihood of him dying of that HIV infection is astronomical compared to a gay black man living in San Francisco, living in Oakland. Mm-hmm. Living in West Hollywood or Los Angeles or probably anywhere else in California for that matter, because California has Medicaid expansion. California has sex education and the availability of condoms and education about PrEP, the daily pill to prevent HIV. All of those things are in place in a state that might as well be a galaxy away from where that gay black man in Mississippi resides. And so... it really is no different. Those societal and economic disparities that affect most everything else that we think of affecting the South versus the rest of the country, except they have real consequences. They have real moral consequences for that gay black man in Mississippi.
Don't go away. The Michelle Meow Show continues right after this.
Babe. I think we're ready.
We're really doing this.
Yeah, I'm ready for our family.
So where do we start?
Starting a family is a team effort, and when life needs a little encouragement, Pacific Fertility Center will be right by your side. As a unified team of the best fertility specialists, guided by the highest ethical standards, Pacific Fertility Center provides patients with compassionate fertility care. Visit pacificfertilitycenter.com.
The Commonwealth Club is a unique organization that brings together people from a variety of backgrounds to explore important issues as a community. Sooner or later, everyone worth hearing comes to our stage. From Marga Gomez to Richard Chamberlain, from James Hormel to Kate Kendall, leading thinkers, activists, politicians, and artists have come to the Commonwealth Club of California. Ted Olson and David Boies came here to discuss their winning legal strategy for same-sex marriage. Jason Collins talked about gay athletes. The Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence discussed activism and good works. Actor and director Rob Reiner explained how he got Hollywood behind same-sex marriage. Barney Frank described what it's like to be gay at the highest levels of Washington. From healthcare reform to transgender rights, from immigration to gay-owned businesses, it's all at the Commonwealth Club. And that's still just a portion of the 450 programs we present every single year, with new programming nearly every single day. Be a part of the conversation. Learn more at commonwealthclub.org, download our free app in iTunes, and join us in person the next time you're in San Francisco. The Commonwealth Club of California puts you face-to-face with today's thought leaders.
Just wanted to put some contrast around that. You know, we went from a time in our history in which the federal government ignored us, and now looking at what the issues are today, I would argue that a good component or to providing the solutions to this is that the government, local, statewide, and federal, still needs to act.
Absolutely. Certainly they do, and yet we're still led by the same homophobia and the same, we now have an administration which is, by many measures, worse than the Reagan 80s that we experienced as the AIDS crisis was in its initial bloom. Now we have an administration that is systematically stripping transgender people of their civil rights and trying to kick them out of the military and trying to deny them health care. And now we have a healthcare system in which we're saying that people have religious liberty to discriminate freely based on their religious beliefs. That applies to nurses, to hospitals, to doctors, to people in a public clinic that say, I do not want to provide this gay man education because his life is an affront to my religious liberty. So you have a very dangerous environment. And, you know, when Larry Kramer talks about the systemic annihilation of gay men off this planet by our government, you start to understand what in the world he's saying, and that it doesn't really sound so extreme after all when we see what this administration is doing to us as a people. And again, mm-hmm. Very real consequences, very real mortal consequences as a result.
Let's talk about U equals U. That might be a new concept for a good number of us.
Let's do.
Because
absolutely.
You know, apart from just looking at what we still need to do as far as the work, let's also celebrate some of the gains and the wins. And so today, U equals U is something that we can celebrate. What is U equals U?
It certainly is. It has become really a rallying cry for HIV advocates around the world, started by the Prevention Access Campaign, which was a very grassroots, started essentially by one person, Bruce Richmond here in the United States, who believed that this message was not getting through, that this science was being ignored because of social stigma. And that science says that a person who is HIV positive, who is on successful treatment and is undetectable meaning that by our current measures, we cannot locate active HIV in your bloodstream. And we've gotten very, very good at that. These new tests are as sensitive as they've ever been. And when we are on successful treatment, people like me, I've been undetectable for 10 years. They have not been able to locate active virus in my body. Yes, it's still there, but it is suppressed to the degree that I am not capable of transmitting my HIV to someone else. That's profound.
Mm-hmm.
To have the science that now proves it without a reasonable doubt, that people who are undetectable, not only can they not transmit the virus, But those who get to being undetectable once they've started treatment are very likely to stay there because they've already demonstrated that they have access to health care, they're taking their medications, and they're taking them regularly. Being undetectable is something that does not waver from one day to the next. It's not like I'm detectable one day and now I'm... No. Once you've achieved undetectable status, it's extremely likely that you're going to stay there over a period of time as long as you keep taking your meds, which people with HIV want to do because we want to stay healthy. The idea for me that after 33 years of living with HIV and feeling like some sort of viral threat to those around me, to my sex partners, etc., to have a feeling that I am no longer that, that I am, in fact, a fully healthy, non-threatening human being is a profound change psychologically for mm-hmm. those of us living with HIV. And it's an important HIV prevention device. If we know that people with HIV, if we'll just get tested, that's my big message, go find out your status. If you find out you're HIV positive, you're able to then access treatment, you will not be infectious to other people. And in fact, being undetectable is, there are zero new infections from those who are undetectable. There's not a single documented case of the hundreds of thousands now of people have been studied who are undetectable. There is not a single case of someone who is undetectable transmitting the virus. It is a better, it is more of a guarantee than condoms, which have a failure rate, you know, because they fail, because they're not used properly, because they're not used all the time. I'm always undetectable. Every day, I'm undetectable. And so what a thrill that is, and what an important prevention device that is, that we, you know, we can stop HIV in its tracks. It will no longer continue to be passed on. And in fact, when you look at San Francisco, they are seeing reversals of new infections among gay men to the tune of 40% a greater success rate in not transmitting HIV and getting new infections. Why is that? Because people with HIV are on successful treatment and are not transmitting the virus to their partners. That and PrEP, the daily pill that's preventing people who are negative from becoming infected.
Ooh, I want to talk about PrEP in just a second, but there are a lot of things that you had just said that brought up some stuff for myself, but I think for a lot of people who are not HIV positive or who are not thinking about HIV prevention, and that can be many people. Now, you talked about, you know, the medicine that has become more advanced, people having access to the medicine. We were at a place once in our history in which, you know, I think a lot of the medicine was testing. It was kind of like not, you know, people reacted to medication, HIV medication. It was at one point tons of different types of medication that people were trying. What's it like now, I guess? Is it one, you know, pill? Are there different options for different people?
Absolutely. I mean, there is, you could fill up a pharmacy with the choices we have, which is amazing because, again, I tested positive at a time where there wasn't any, and the first drug was years away. But it's not simply, you know, all the things are better than it was in 1985. It is, by any measure, things are the availability, the selection we have of drugs to take, medications to take, is very wide, very broad, and should be acceptable to just about anybody. By that I mean side effects. You know, I went through all those early drugs where there were side effects and terrible things happening, and we were getting wasting and all sorts of physical, you know, abnormalities as a result. That's not the case anymore. And as a matter of fact, as someone who is used to taking, you know, I was taking handfuls of pills for many years, I take two pills in the morning. I down it with my daily vitamin and my little aspirin. And that's it. I don't think about it for the rest of the day until the next morning. I take two more pills. And that controls my HIV. That suppresses my virus and makes me undetectable. That's amazing. And you know what? If for some reason I had a reaction to one of those pills or both of those pills, there's a whole long list of other ones that I could take as an alternative. No one, you know, I don't want to make a sweeping generalization, but by and large, no one with HIV should have to suffer a side effect from the medication they're taking. Because there are so many options. Of course, you have to have access, meaning you have to have insurance, or you have to go to a clinic that is offering you meds through some sort of governmental program. But we do have those options in this country for the medicines to be available and accessible to most everyone.
Thank you so much for that. And part of that question is, you know, again, I think a lot of people are ignorant, general, you know, mainstream media. Sometimes they don't cover HIV issues in a way in which people totally understand that. And I think that if everyone understood a little bit more than they do about this issue, our community would be a whole lot stronger and a whole lot more confident, which hopefully then leads to the access part in what you're talking about. It sounds like, you know, we have the answer to the best of our ability. It's just about also access as well. The other, you know, question that I had about this is you mentioned PrEP, and people have been talking a whole lot about PrEP. Sometimes it's been controversial, and now I think that people have a better understanding of it. But again, for the purpose of also educating folks who don't know a whole lot about HIV issues, what is PrEP, and when we talk about preventative measures and how it could be a prevention tool, and you also talked about, you know, even compared to condom usage and just what health officials might be advocating if you are thinking about using PrEP, and what findings are there, as some men have been concerned about the side effects.
Mm-hmm. Well, PrEP is a strategy. In other words, PrEP isn't a particular pill. It's a strategy. PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis, preventing something before it happens, right? So this is a pill. Right now, the only FDA-approved pill for PrEP is Truvada. And Truvada was studied for this purpose because it had a low side effect profile, because it was fairly tolerable. It was used already as a medication for people living with HIV, but they studied it as something that might be good prophylactically before. And in fact, it's worked out great. Now, it does have side effects for some people. And initially, those side effects, I think, were understated. And so people should be monitored. But that's part of what the whole PrEP thing is about. You don't just get on PrEP and take pills and that's it. It's a commitment. If you are if you're at risk, if you believe that you are, you know, at risk for becoming infected with HIV because you don't always use a condom and for whatever reason, then you'll want to make a commitment to take PrEP, and that means going to your doctor, to, you know, getting an HIV test, making sure you're negative, being prescribed PrEP, and then going back to your doctor every few months so that they can take blood work and just make sure you're not getting side effects, which are there are some kidney problems or bone density problems that can be associated with the use of Truvada. They have been minimal, but they don't want to take any chances, so they want to make sure, you know, they want to check you out every few months to make sure that it's okay. The benefits are enormous because those who take PrEP regularly, among those who do take the pill as prescribed each day, they will have in the high 90s, 96, 97, 98% chance of not contracting HIV. Now, that doesn't mean that if you have sex 100 times, then the 98th time you will contract HIV. That's not how these, you know, people get caught up in this, the origami of all of these numbers. What it means is each and every time you do have sex, there is a 98% chance that you are protected. That's a pretty good odd each and every time. And that is, by the way, again, better odds than a condom, which are only considered effective 90% of the time or less, because they're not used every time, because they fail, because they're not used correctly. The great thing about taking a pill every day to prevent HIV is that you're not having to take it, you don't have to slip it on your penis in the heat of the moment. Oh my gosh, okay, let me grab this out of my nightstand. You know, never mind, it's too much trouble, let's just go. You know, you don't have to make those decisions when you're not thinking with your brain. You take that pill every morning with your orange juice, and you're done. And then you don't have to make those decisions in the heat of the moment. Is it true that a lot of people who are taking PrEP are doing so because they don't always use condoms? Yes, that's exactly right. And thank God, because those are exactly who PrEP was designed for. I don't have much patience for the judgment that comes out of people about who it is that's choosing to use PrEP. Mm-hmm. You know, if it is designed for people who are at risk. If you are using a condom every single time you have sex, well, God bless you. You may not be a strong candidate for PrEP. But if you ever don't use one, which the majority of gay men fall into that category, then they may be a candidate for PrEP, and they should proudly take it and feel good about the fact that they are taking care of their health, and they should pay no attention to these online trolls who want to say that people who take PrEP are promiscuous or are this or that. The people who take PrEP are those that are taking the most pride in their bodies and their lives.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking time to answer that. I have so many questions for you, but, you know, obviously I can't talk to you all day long, which I wish I could. But you produced a series of videos while you were there at AIDS 2018 in Amsterdam. And, you know, from a lot of what I collected from watching a few of the videos was that sexual liberation, which was, you know, part of the gay liberation as well, but sexual liberation has continued on throughout the history of AIDS or HIV AIDS. And I think that that's a very, very important component. And some people might be surprised, but for a lot of people around the world, you know, sexual liberation is kind of, it's like, so for some countries or for some people, it's also could be a new thing. So I wanted to, you know, ask for you to touch on that and some of the people that you talk to who are standing out and being very proud and also, you know, marching, protesting for the right to the opportunity, the freedom of expression.
Well, my coverage in Amsterdam was sponsored by IMPACT, which is Global Action for Gay Men's Health and Rights. And they asked me to focus on the lives of gay men through sex-positive stories. So anyone that reviews my video coverage of the conference is going to see me in sex clubs, talking to gay sex workers, talking to guys who are into leather and fetish gear, in the gay sauna, talking about their hepatitis C prevention campaigns. I was all over the place and really focused kind of on the sexuality and the sexual lives of the men that I talked to. Those videos can be viewed on myfabulousdisease.com, and you can go through all of them and choose which ones you want to watch. And so thanks for bringing that up. Now, the question of pleasure, sexual pleasure, is something that we as a community haven't been able to talk about for more than a generation. Because we have been muzzled about speaking of pleasure because we've all been so traumatized and terrified by HIV. And for gay men, at least, for a generation, we have been told to put a barrier between ourselves and our partner. And if we don't, then we're committing some sort of a violent self-loathing act, when in fact, you know, we deserve a full and satisfying sexual existence just like any other human being on this planet. That includes having sex without a barrier with our partner if that's what we choose to do, as long as we're doing it responsibly. Doing it with a partner you know is undetectable is responsible. Doing it with a partner with whom you're using a condom is responsible. Doing it with a partner without a condom but who is on PrEP is responsible. There's more than one kind of protected sex now. And as a result, more and more activists are talking about pleasure again, about how much fun it is to have sex, how much fun it is to have unprotected, that is, not unprotected, see, I'm guilty of that myself, of having sex without a barrier with our partners again. There's value in that. There is emotional, sexual, and spiritual value to our sex lives and body fluids flying hither and gone. It's fun. It's sexy. It's intimate. It's spiritual. It is all of those things for us as human beings. And now we get to talk about that again because there are ways to do it while still protecting ourselves. And yet, we've had it more than a generation where we've had death and dying and mortality and judgments being flung about. And it's been difficult to say, wait a second, I would like to have a full and satisfying sex life, and that includes body fluids and doing with them what I'd like to do with them. That's meaningful to me. And to be able to say that and experience it and do it in a way that's responsible again, that's really hard for people to do. And so there's a lot of kind of tension between activists like me who are saying that is possible, we have a right to it, we can do it responsibly, and I'm doing that and I love it. I don't use condoms in my relationship. And I don't have to. And thank God for that. And my being HIV positive doesn't prevent me from protecting my partner and being able to have a full and satisfying sex life without having to rely on a condom. Just my saying that out loud was heresy, even 5 years ago, mm-hmm. maybe even 3 years ago. Maybe from some of your listeners, they're freaked out by my saying that now. But the fact is I can do that and I can be responsible, and we get to have these conversations again about what pleasurable sex means and how we're entitled to it and how we can do it in a responsible way.
Oh, that was so beautifully said. I almost think that that's the way to end the interview. But I did have one last question, and that question is really about looking forward to the future and, you know, you wrapping up this conference fresh from it, having a different lens, covering this topic for so long. I mean, what are some of those things to look forward to? I think you've already covered a whole lot of it in this interview, but just to kind of, you know, look back at the conference itself and maybe something new that you learned or meeting some new people, what might be something that we need to be thinking about leading up to the next conference?
I think the most I get out of these conferences is the inspiration from meeting people around the world who share a common goal, and that is the health of their community. And our community health is more than just whether we get HIV or not. Our community health as LGBTQ people is about our ability to love one another and love ourselves and take care of ourselves. Take care of our bodies, our minds, our spirits. And all of those things, to me, are satisfied by my activism in HIV. It doesn't have to be that for you. You're an activist in your own right. You are standing up and being counted in your own way. We all get to participate in this grand design of humanity here, right? So I just live as someone who has been living with HIV much, much longer than I ever thought possible. And I wake up every morning with joy and gratitude, and I believe in the power of us as a community, and I don't believe that power can be crushed by the occupant of our White House or any single administration. We just have to get out there and continue fighting for the lives that we know we deserve.
Mark, thank you so much for sharing you with us here on the Michelle Meow Show.
I appreciate it so much. Thanks for the pleasure of speaking to you.
For more information or to take a look at some of those videos we talked about, but most importantly, to get some content from Mark, he's just simply one of the best, head to markskking.com. www.progressiveproject.com. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to the Progressive Voices Network, streaming the best in progressive talk 24/7. Keep the progressive conversation going on by joining our community. Each week, we send out an email that covers important things taking place in the Progressive Voices Network and throughout the progressive world. Be the first to know of upcoming shows, schedule changes, exclusive programming, and more. Simply go to progressivevoices.com and sign up for our mailing list. It's that easy. Progressivevoices.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining the Progressive Voices community.
Babe. I think we're ready.
We're really doing this.
Yeah, I'm ready for our family.
So where do we start?
Starting a family is a team effort, and when life needs a little encouragement, Pacific Fertility Center will be right by your side. As a unified team of the best fertility specialists, guided by the highest ethical standards, Pacific Fertility Center provides patients with compassionate fertility care. Visit pacificfertilitycenter.com.
Weatherford BMW is where I spend a lot of my time. I love what I do and I love the people I work with. But work's not the only thing I love. I love the everyday simple things in life, like mornings at my favorite coffee shop, taking walks with my dogs around Point Isabel, and spoiling my partner for a scenic but thrilling ride. That's the beauty of living the Bay Area dream. We're just being ourselves, living our authentic life.
Live your authentic life, a special message by Weatherford BMW.
Thanks for listening to the Progressive Voices Network, streaming the best in progressive talk 24/7. Keep the progressive conversation going on by joining our community. Each week, we send out an email that covers important things taking place in the Progressive Voices Network and throughout the progressive world. Be the first to know of upcoming shows, schedule changes, exclusive programming, and more. Simply go to progressivevoices.com and sign up for our mailing list. It's that easy. Progressivevoices.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining the Progressive Voices community.
Welcome back to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z, covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. It was great talking to activist, blogger, author, writer Mark S. King about his award-winning blog and about his work covering AIDS and HIV issues and just kind of how it all intersects. We didn't get a chance to go into it during the interview, but after we stopped recording, we talked about even how the Muslim ban hurts folks within the HIV AIDS community. So, for example, the AIDS conference has plans to be in San Francisco in 2020. But if there's a Muslim ban in place, how are people, how are activists, how are those who are supposed to benefit from the conference able to be here? And so there's a real effort to change the location of the next conference. But just to kind of think about that as American citizens or people who live in America or people who are making these rules and policies, none of this makes a whole lot of sense. And if we're really talking about reform when it comes to immigration, why aren't we doing the work? I want to spend some time before the show ends or in the second half of the program to really talk about what's on my mind. And immigration is weighing heavily on my mind. Of course, I've mentioned it here on the show before. I never really thought about it in this way until I met somebody that I absolutely fell in love with, and it impacted me personally, and it continues to do so. So, for example, today there was a Facebook post. Melanie Nathan, who's been on the show many times, posted about something that's been going or that's been shared virally on Facebook. It was an article that talked about how immigration officials are showing up on the buses or on the trains and asking people if they are United States citizens. Now, according to Department of Homeland Security, it's legal for immigration officials to ask within 100 miles of a border. So big cities like San Francisco, New York were all impacted. Florida, an entire state, is within 100 miles of a border, so the entire state is impacted. They can ask these questions, but it doesn't mean that you don't have rights, and that's important to know. As United States citizens, your right is that you don't have to answer this question. You could respond with, "I do not wish to answer this question." So Customs and Border Patrol agents or immigrant officials could question you further. They could ask you to, or they could pressure you to answer that question. But in order to detain you, they have to have reasonable suspicion to arrest. Reasonable suspicion. So you have to understand what that actually means. And reasonable suspicion is not what you look like. If you look like, and I put that in air quotes, an undocumented person who's here illegally, that is not reasonable suspicion to arrest. So the next question you can ask, if you are being asked about your immigration status, you can ask if you are being detained or free to go. And if the officer does not have reasonable suspicion, they should let you go. And if they do have reasonable suspicion, or that they, actually, I should rephrase that. If they end up detaining you and asking you to leave the bus and to search your belongings, ask what is the cause? What is the cause? That's really important. There have been some cases in which United States citizens have stood up to these Customs and Border Patrol agents and denied to answer the question the entire time, even after being detained. And at some point, they have to let you go, because the longer they keep you, the more reasonable suspicions they need to justify the detention. If you are an undocumented person, I absolutely would urge for you to reach out to an attorney or the ACLU to fully understand what your rights are. But yes, even your rights, you do not have to answer that question. If you end up being detained, make sure you have proper documentation and never lie. Never lie to an immigration official about your status. That's something that I definitely want to spread here or share here on the program, is to know your rights. The ACLU has a wonderful way of explaining it, the 100-mile border situation, as well as what to do if you get detained, if you get questioned. So head to ACLU.org and find out more information. The more knowledge you have, the more power you have. There's something else that I want to bring up, and we will definitely do a program with the Commonwealth Club to address this. And there's this thing called public charge. So public charge, basically, in my own words at least, is a way to deny someone status here in the United States if they may become public charge, or basically completely dependent on the United States for assistance. So what I'm talking about, when you apply to adjust your status, part of it is being able to demonstrate that you will not wholly rely on social services for your livelihood, for your family's livelihood, and in some ways be able to financially be independent, or somebody else be responsible for you in this way. And so the public charges, what I should say is that there have been some drafts that have been leaked to certain immigrant advocates or immigration advocates who are now talking about this public charge that might change, or the policy surrounding public charge. And it would expand to include, Obamacare, or purchasing healthcare in the marketplace and using or receiving tax credits at the same time. It would also extend or expand to include if you're a recipient of Medicare, Medicaid. Obviously, it would impact families who are currently depending on programs like WIC, SNAP, welfare. And so what they're trying to do in this draft that people have seen is to make it so that if you demonstrate a real need for these programs, including your dependents that are, or who are United States citizens, it's possible for them to deny you status or a green card. So I'm going to read through some stuff that I've gotten, that I've been on a few calls, and again, we'll plan to have a full conversation of how this might impact families. But if they end up being able to finalize these new policy changes, it would affect, I think, like 20 million families. This is an absolute attack to the immigrant community, and not just the immigrant community, but for those of us who are trying to have a healthy life. This would impact our economy in so many ways. So as I mentioned before, the public charge has been a part of the federal immigration law for decades. So it's not new, and it's designed to identify people who might depend on government benefits as main source of support. So the government can determine someone is likely to become a public charge and then, you know, deny admission to the United States or refuse an application for lawful permanent residency or a green card. So the White House currently is reviewing a proposal, like I had mentioned, that would change the public charge policy, basically forcing immigrant families to make this very impossible choice between meeting your basic needs or keeping your families together in the country. So think about that. You would basically, if this charge was finalized, what you would say to yourself is, do I apply for these benefits? Do I use these benefits in order to become a stronger family, to get basic needs, to help move you forward in life, to, you know, for what we all stand for here in this country? Or risk that to try a different way to make it, or go forward with the benefits and risk being in the country with your family? It's an impossible, there's no or, and I use that, but it's impossible when you're forcing immigrant families to make a decision like this. So if it's finalized, and this is being proposed by the Trump administration, it would really fundamentally change who we are as a country, truly, and the meaning of what we stand for as far as the values, because you're basically, you know, at some point telling folks that we're an open door country. We want people to come here to work hard, achieve a better life, but only opening it up to a certain, I guess, percentage of people. I don't know. I don't actually, if this is to pass, I'm not really sure if we are even an open country anymore. There are lots of tax-paying immigrant parents who have United States citizen children. For example, my mom. I'm a United States citizen child, my mother, a refugee, but an immigrant who came here and who, yes, the programs that helped our healthcare, that helped us with food, that led to us being adults in which, as United States citizen adults now, I argue that we contribute. We contribute a whole lot more. We've had to incur lots of debt to be able to live here. And simply because, you know, my mom had to do whatever she had to do. So imagine taking that away. I want to kind of start finalizing my thoughts here, but basically going back to explaining public charge and how this could change. These are some of the programs that can be added to the public charge. So if the proposed rule is finalized, immigration officials could consider whether individuals or any of their dependent family members, including United States citizen children, they can consider if they'll be able to be together, to be here to live in the United States simply for receiving government programs, and those government programs would expand to include earned income tax credit, non-emergency Medicaid, Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, subsidies provided through the Affordable Care Act, simply a purchasing healthcare through the marketplace, Obamacare. This is how horrible of an administration this is. So let's keep going. Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC, housing assistance, such as Section 8, or housing vouchers, Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or comparable state and local programs. So be on the lookout. As I mentioned before, this is all in draft form. I think it's in the budget committee of the department. The next steps, I guess if it is approved, it will have to be announced, and then the public has 60 days to comment. So stay vigilant, stay resisting, and that time's going to come in which we will have to fight back. We'll have to share our stories. I would advocate, you know, start talking to immigrant families right now and start understanding what, you know, powers that we have, that we're a strong community. Within those 60 days, hopefully we'll be able to reverse some of this decision-making before they finalize any changes to the public charge policy. If you have any questions or want to get involved, visit protectingimmigrantfamilies.org. I think sharing stories is also very important. So I've added an Instagram account. I might add a Facebook page in which I'll share experiences of my own individual and independent experiences of navigating what, you know, what it's like to be an immigrant family here in America during the Trump administration. I think that sharing our authentic lived experiences of how difficult it is, even through, you know, my legal right as a United States citizen who's married someone from a different country. I mean, just looking at it from that perspective of how difficult, you know, the process is, now magnify that and go even lower. And, you know, somebody who might not be a United States citizen or you know, whatever the circumstances are, what we're trying to do is share enough stories so that people really understand, you know, immigrant rights, immigrant issues, and how changing any of this really strips away who we are as a country. So you could follow me on my social media, head to michellemiao.com. Thanks for tuning in. I think for the rest of the program, we will air a little bit of content from stuff that we did from voices of other activists in our community. Again, head to michellemiao.com for everything else. We'll see you next time.
Hi, my name is Courtney Ziegler, and I'm the founder of TransHack, which is an organization focused on creating technology for the trans community and visibility for trans technologists and entrepreneurs. Tech is like the new industrial revolution. There's so many opportunities for wealth building and wealth creation. It's perfect for the trans community, which experiences strong amounts of unemployment and low wages. TransHack provides an opportunity for trans individuals to take advantage of the wealth creation that the tech industry provides. It's a space in which people who are in charge of innovation and development, all these awesome things that we are able to use through technology, are paid really well for that. And so I think that trans people should definitely have their hand in that space and creating that. And so TransHack provides that opportunity. I got my first computer when I was 15 years old in the 90s, and it changed my world ever since then. And I went on to become an independent filmmaker who had to not only write and direct my own films, but also was kind of doing the technical stuff behind it, which is the editing and the capturing, all those things. I've always had this kind of tech-based background. I'm just very curious about a lot of things and just very fascinated about things that I don't know and things that can make me a better person. All of that motivates me. I'm just like, what else can I know? What else can I do? What else can I learn? Success to me means a number of things. I think right now in my life personally, it means waking up every day and feeling proud of the work that I'm doing and proud of myself. Just know what you want to get out of any particular industry. It's not an industry that's 100% inclusive in the ways that it should be, in the ways that it's progressing towards, of all types of people in terms of creating the tech and the industry itself, building its infrastructure. But that's also exciting in the fact that, like, people like me have a lot of room to change a lot of things and a lot of precedent to set. So, and that is the epitome of success.
Spotlight on Success and Achievement is brought to you by Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far.
Babe, I think we're ready.
We're really doing this.
Yeah, I'm ready for our family.
So where do we start?
Starting a family is a team effort, and when life needs a little encouragement, Pacific Fertility Center will be right by your side. As a unified team of the best fertility specialists, guided by the highest ethical standards, Pacific Fertility Center provides patients with compassionate fertility care. Visit pacificfertilitycenter.com.